This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
This sad anniversary of 6 months reminds us that we have to keep working, and we know what needs to be done. And we have to remain cautiously optimistic that our measures will pay and that we will eventually end the outbreak of Ebola.
That's WHO spokesman Tarik Jasarevic talking about the situation in the DRC more than 6 months after the Ebola outbreak. Details coming up. Also, two top opposition leaders in Zimbabwe declined an invitation to join a dialogue with President Emmerson Mnangagwa and his ZANU-PF party. And in Nigeria, a leading opposition presidential candidate has fueled debate by calling for privatization of government-owned Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the spread of Ebola continues in the eastern DRC with a total of 789 confirmed and probable cases, including 488 deaths since the outbreak was first reported August 1st. The complications of fighting such a deadly disease in an active conflict zone remain, but there is some cautious optimism in the international mission to contain it. What's not visible in the rising numbers is that many of the new cases have switched from the general public, which is hard to trace, to local community health centers where people go for treatment of other ailments. VOA's Paul Alexander spoke with World Health Organization spokesman Tarik Jasarevic for an update on the situation.
This sad anniversary of 6 months reminds us that we have to keep working, and we know what needs to be done, and we have to remain cautiously optimistic that our measures will pay and that we will eventually end the outbreak of Ebola.
That sounds like a little bit of the cautious optimism we've heard recently, but other experts have recently made a call in Lancet for an emergency declaration. Where do we stand on that?
Well, we already had a first meeting of emergency committee under international health regulations on October 17th this year. At that time, the committee, while noting that this is a serious outbreak and that the response has to be fully supported by everyone, the criteria for declaring public health emergency of international concern have not been met at that time. WHO is continuously monitoring this outbreak in DRC, and we are looking for signs of shifting epidemiology or wider spread, especially if there was a spread across border. So there is a regular risk assessment that we are doing for our Director General decision on whether escalated actions are needed, including exactly calling for another meeting of emergency committee and the IHR. So we have to really understand that declaring public health emergency of national concern is not linked to the level of response that is already there, where we have more than 500 staff.
It does seem that the affected area has been expanding at least somewhat, and now South Sudan has joined Rwanda in vaccinating health workers.
Well, it's difficult to predict, Paul, what will happen. From the beginning of the outbreak, we were warning against spread of the disease across border, and it has not happened yet. There is a systematic screening of travelers across the border, so we make sure that all alerts are picked up and investigated. Inside DR Congo, more than 70,000 people have been vaccinated, and we believe that this helped avoid much higher number of Ebola cases. But obviously, this is a very challenging security context. For example, we had now cases in Kaina area, that's south of Butembo, that's considered as a security sensitive area. We also had instances of community mistrust especially in Katwa, where we have seen an increased number of cases in past weeks. But we really know what works well. We really need to train health workers on infection prevention and control measures in health centers. We understand that lots of transmission is happening at the health facilities, as opposite to having infections in community, which was the case previously.
That was VOA's Paul Alexander speaking with WHO spokesman Tariq Jasarevic. Two top opposition leaders in Zimbabwe declined an invitation to join a dialogue with President Emmerson Mnangagwa and his ZANU-PF party. Mnangagwa invited all the candidates who contested in last year's elections to join him to find ways to solve some of the country's many problems. Reporter Kuzai Zanawashi has details.
Most of President Mnangagwa's political rivals in last July's election attended the dialogue meeting. The notable exceptions: the leader of the main opposition, MDC Alliance, Nelson Chamisa, and former vice president and leader of the National People's Party, Joyce Mujuru. Speaking at Wednesday's meeting, Mnangagwa expressed his hopes for long-term dialogue.
It is my hope that this inaugural dialogue by our political parties will provide a firm foundation upon which, together and without undue foreign interference, we can build the Zimbabwe we all want.
He adds that the dialogue is a fulfillment of his inauguration promise to engage other opposition leaders, given that no one has a monopoly on good ideas. Rashid Mukundu is a political analyst, and he has reservations about the idea of this form of political dialogue.
That grouping is not representative of any group in Zimbabwe, be it political or otherwise. And this is a window dressing form of dialogue which is devoid of sincerity. It is devoid of legitimacy.
Mukundu adds that the meeting took place as the government has been cracking down on opposition activists and civic society leaders. In the past several weeks, the country has been hit by numerous protests over the sharp rise in fuel prices and shortages of basic goods and currency. Security forces responded with force against the protesters, with the reports of hundreds of arrests and scores being injured by gunfire and beating. Nkululeko Sibanda is the spokesperson of the opposition's Nelson Chamisa.
Well, what is clear is that there was no dialogue meeting, as it were. There was a sit-down and a photo opportunity for Mr. Mnangagwa. The agenda for a national dialogue, which would not be a waste of time, should be one that considers or addresses the major issues. That's the political crisis, the law, the legitimacy of the past election, the economy, and our international re-engagement.
The MDC Alliance has said government should release all political prisoners before a genuine dialogue can be held. Mukundu says talks should be between the ZANU-PF and the MDC Alliance, and the talks should have an independent facilitator who can help resolve Zimbabwe's crisis. Thursday, the Zimbabwe Council of Churches organized another national dialogue, which Chamisa and other community stakeholders attended. President Mnangagwa, however, sent representatives and did not attend. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
14 past the hour, you're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. On just over a week, Nigerians vote in their presidential election. The top candidates are President Muhammadu Buhari from the All Progressives Party and former Vice President Atiku Abubakar of the People's Democratic Party. In Lagos this weekend, Buhari's APC is holding major campaign events. VOA's Peter Kloti is in Lagos and he's taken to the streets to hear what people are saying about the election. One person he spoke with is Johnson Abubakar, who says he will not vote on election day.
Chief, so you are telling us that you are not going to vote in the upcoming election. Why?
I'm not going to vote because the system has failed us. What we want, I'm not benefiting anything directly from the system. No job, no incentive, nothing. So I see no reason why somebody like me should go to the polling booth, queue, be under the sun and vote.
But some people say that if you don't vote, then you make people come to rule and you don't have control over...
Either I vote or not,
right?
The vote doesn't count.
But what about your civic duty?
Wait. You are talking about the civic duty. I'm telling you that the vote doesn't count because they know their ways. They have their ways. Either you vote or not, the winner will surely emerge. My vote counts if I vote. But I'm telling you that the vote does not count.
Why?
They have their manipulations. Yeah, they have their manipulations in the sense that, okay, now, we are talking about voting. At the end of the day, there's going to be rigging, manipulations. They come up with results that... At the end of the day, they end up in the court. Court has nothing doing about the, you know, the evidences of either votes were rigged at social polling booth or the other. But the major reason why I'm not going to vote is that the system has failed. We've been in the system for like...
So what do you expect the system? Let me ask you, what... Do you expect the system to do? You said it's failed so far. Okay, so what do you expect to happen in order for it to work for you?
Yeah, you see, we have been talking about the independence of the electoral system. That is the INEC. But I am telling you that INEC is not independent. INEC is still directly under the system. So the system influences INEC. As I'm talking to you, they know who is going to rule. They know who is going to win. So if you now say whether my vote counts or not, I'm only wasting my time. Mm. Because we have the councils of, what do we call them? Councils of head of states. If they don't want Buhari to come there in the first place, they wouldn't have even allowed him to contest. If they don't want Atiku to come there as an alternative, they will not even allow him to contest in the first place. So they know the way they direct the system. They know if this person they don't win, this one will win. Mm. So these are the two people, they are fit.
All right. Okay.
They are fit. Let the two of them contest. You remember the time of Tofa and Abiola? The projection was that if Tofa win, they would have handed over to Tofa. But because Tofa did not win till tomorrow, Abiola did not see that place. So the way the direction things are going now, if Buhari should win, they will allow him to rule. If Atiku should win, they will allow him to. But let someone else who is out of that council, out of the approver, come there and win, you will not see any light of the day.
That was Johnson Abubakar, who was speaking to VOA's Peter Kloti. With just over a week before Nigeria's general elections, an opposition presidential candidate has fueled the debate by calling for privatization of government-owned Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, NNPC. Atiku Abubakar of the People's Democratic Party says, if elected, he would retain just 10% of NNPCs for the federal government. The NNPC was established in 1977 as the oil corporation through which the government regulates and participates in the country's petroleum industry. Atiku says the company should be more profitable by now. On the other hand, the ruling All Progressives Congress says Atiku is pursuing a capitalist agenda. The company's national chairman says Atiku plans to sell the company to foreigners since no Nigerian can afford it. James Emmanuel is an economist in Lagos. He spoke to reporter Mike Mbonye on the benefits and drawbacks of privatizing the company. He says if the company is sold, the government should ensure that there is no gap between the rich and the poor.
The NNPC, it's Nigeria's property, federal government property. And from the look of things, the NNPC has been run by the federal government in the interest of the generality of the populace, the Nigerian populace. So to that extent, the NNPC is a national asset. which should remain national, provided it is run efficiently and effectively. In that case, it would remain. Otherwise, the NNPC becomes a big elephant that would be hardly moved by anybody, meaning would be inefficient. So government will not be able to handle it. Therefore, it should be sold. But the point is, who would buy it? How would the sale be made? That's a very, very big question that would beg so many other questions.
Why did previous administrations in Nigeria refuse to privatize the company?
Well, privatization is selling, in a way, in a sense. And I've told you that NNPC is a national asset. And you come to think of it, the Nigerian economy is monocultural. So NNPC is like the symbol of Nigeria when it comes to the oil industry. So NNPC is segmented. It's a huge elephant which has so many rooms and so many things are done in the NNPC, from exploration, contracts, etc., down to refining. So if government has to run it like government has done before, it has to be run efficiently to justify the coming of government. And that means that every Nigerian as a stakeholder will have to have some benefits from NNPC.
The ruling All Progressives Congress, APC, says it is opposed to the sale and Atiku's move is aimed at enriching his friends. What's your take on this too?
Well, the point is, I don't know how Mr. Atiku will want to go about it, the former vice president and our presidential candidate. If I had his manifesto before me, if I had how he would want to go about it, about the sale of NNPC, to whom would some parts of NNPC be sold, then I could pass a judgment. For now, I don't know how he wants to go about it. But basically, he's a businessman. Maybe he has seen that NNPC is not being run efficiently, so he wants to sell maybe part of the NNPC or whatever to introduce some efficiency. We've talked about 10%. Well, you know, that would be for the Nigerian government and 90%. So I don't know who the buyers would be. So I would not be able to say he wants to sell to his cronies, wants to sell to his friends, because I don't know. But the point is, if you are selling, then you have to sell in such a way that many Nigerians, not necessarily the richest, even the poor man could have a stake in the buying of this.
What are the potential benefits and drawbacks of privatization?
Privatization is a very, very serious business. Of course, it has two sides. It has drawbacks, it has benefits, opportunities. But the point is, I personally feel when an organization is privatized, every kobo would be accounted for. Every move, every decision would be taken promptly. Generally, in the case of NNPC, privatization brings in efficiency, at least in theory. And most of the time, practically, it helps. But on the other hand, it skews the earnings of the people. Because if something like NNPC is privatized, is handed, sold to the rich, then the rich will become richer and the poor become poorer. So you have that inequality, which maybe government as a joker, they have a way, particularly the article of government, if they win the elections and if they sell, they will have a way of reducing this inequality, because the inequality will be there. The economy, the NNPC will be more efficient, but they'll put more money into rich hands. Those who are rich will be richer. And those who are poor maybe will not be. The inequality will be there. The gap will be there. So government should think, in case he wins the election and wants to privatize, should think of how to recycle the money so that that inequality should be bridged. At least there'll be no case of 91% owning 99% of the resources while the 99% poor would own 1%. So they have to be that balance that should be struck.
That was economist James Emmanuel speaking with reporter Mike Mbonye in Lagos, Nigeria. Lake Kivu has long carried the threat of catastrophe, with deadly pockets of methane gas that are believed to be responsible for local extinctions about every 1,000 years, and smaller deadly events in between. Now, there are hopes that the threat can be eased and turned into an economic and development boost by providing electricity to ease the country's chronic power shortage. The Rwanda Development Board says the government has signed a $400 million deal aimed at producing bottled gas from the lake. Eugene Uimana has more details from Kigali.
The Rwanda Development Board, RDB, says the seven-year deal was signed with the Gazmeth Energy, owned by businessmen in the US, Nigeria and Rwanda. Like other lakes around the world, Lake Kivu lies in a volcanic region. Scientists say removing and using the gas may prevent eruptions that could harm thousands of Rwandans and Congolese living around the lake. And it would help Rwanda achieve its goal of connecting all households to power by 2024. A 2017 report said only 35% are connected now. Many Rwandans are eager to hear about this deal. Muhire Jean-Baptiste lives in Kigali City.
This lake is our lake. It's free. The methane is free. Why not exploit it and produce electricity? It comes cheaper than using thermal plants or hydraulic plants, where we will have to buy the source of energy in order to create the electricity.
For Rwanda's Water and Sanitation Corporation, the stated deal is poison turned into cure. Umtoni Augusta is in charge of Lake Kivu stability. Rwandans who live on the lake's shore are highly expecting much from this project because they fear that any time it can erupt. Now they are wondering what this gas extraction would bring. We hope that if all goes successfully, then many Rwandans will benefit and use gas not only by getting electricity, but also in cooking. Several economic experts claim the electricity shortage seems to be a break to Rwanda's rapidly growing industry sector. Economist Naftali Nyangwi says methane gas could be the fast solution if the extracting projects are well managed. Rwanda extremely needs energy, especially for industries. And all of these efforts to look for other electricity sources are going to contribute to exploit all necessary resources for more investment to be put into Rwandan industries.
Mettre à disposition des investissements économiques.
Rwandan Development Board says the bottled gas should be on sale within 2 years. Rwanda already has two other companies that extract gas from Lake Kivu to boost electricity plants. When officially launching the Kivu Water Methane Power Plant in 2016, President Paul Kagame said the 25-megawatt project isn't enough yet. He explained how it's a milestone it is to even think of exploiting Kivu.
They tried so many times and failed so many times. In the end, not only have they succeeded, we have all succeeded. 25.6 megawatts won't address our energy or power problems, but it is an indication of what is possible in trying to address this challenge.
First discovered in 1036, the methane gas deposits under the lake are believed to total approximately 60 billion cubic meters, with 300 billion cubic meters of carbon dioxide. Full extraction could bring 960 megawatts, for more than five times what Rwanda has now. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Calvin Fowler, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
This is Peter Clote of VOA Africa. I am in Nigeria to cover the general election. Listen to my daily reports when you tune in to our news shows. Africa News Tonight, Daybreak Africa, Nightline Africa, an international edition for the latest from Lagos.